It's the great Dante Read Through.
It's the great Dante Read Through, where we are reading through all of the comic strip, The Adventures of Nicolai Dante. Co-created by Robbie Morrison and Simon Fraser from the weekly science fiction anthology comic, 2000 AD.
I'm Simon Fraser.
And I'm Edie Nugent, freelance writer and Simon's wife. Join us as we swashbuckle our way through the Russian Empire of the future. Warning, there will be spoilers. We will be talking in depth about these comics, so if you haven't read them yet, listen at your own risk. To join our book club and read along with us, go to shop.2000ad.com to pick up the books in hard copy or digital.
This podcast was recorded live at the Lawless Comic Convention in Bristol on the 25th and 26th of May this year. We'd like to say thanks very much to Sue Hadrill and her team for helping us set up this thing, and also to the anonymous sound guy on the desk. We couldn't find out your name, but you did a great job. Respect. Thank you. And now on with the show.
Today, we're reading Destiny's Child, found in Prog's 2008. And
just 2008, that's
2008,
it's
a special, yes.
Yes. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Edie.
And hello, irregulars. And welcome to the great Dante Read Through, live. Applause or something. Thank you. Right up top, I'd like to welcome our incredibly special guest, really the most special guest we could have. It's Robbie Morrison. Yay!
Which is completely unplanned. We did not expect this ourselves.
Yes. It's all a bit on the hoof, isn't it?
We were planning to like wait till the end and then attack him with a list of like weird questions, but we haven't got that list.
But then
and
you decided to pop up,
he just showed up. He preempted us.
Yeah, I said earlier, I'll just gate crash whatever party's going.
And this is a party.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for coming all the way from the, is it a Shropshire area?
Shropshire, yeah.
Down to Bristol. To be with us, the writer of all this great stuff that we've spent several years reading through now. And we're reading Destiny's Child today, which I was reminding you what it was about in the
Yeah, I have no idea. I essentially thought, did I come up with a title as bad as that for a story? Obviously I did.
Yeah, well,
so
you did.
Who
you
wrote
did.
It and who drew it?
Who wrote it, who drew it, who lettered it. So it was written by Robbie Morrison.
Him there.
This guy here. The art is by Mr. John Burns.
Sadly departed,
sadly
great
departed
John, Burns.
John Burns.
Yes.
And lettering by powerhouse Annie Parkhouse.
Annie Parkhouse.
Okay. So Destiny's Child opens with the line, when she was 3 years old, Odessa saw her mother die. So we're in for another Robbie Morrison romp.
Yeah, I always like a cheerful opening.
I mean, it is a pretty badass opening line, though, it must be said. So our adorable little toe-headed Odessa was apparently sitting, having a nice Sunday in the park with George-style picnic with her mother when she saw into the future for the first time, and it was her mother's death 3 years from now. It couldn't be something nice she saw in the future, like she saw that cool day at the parade where there were elephants.
It could have been, but that would have been a different story and probably someone other than me writing it, I'm
afraid. Yes, that's fair. So then poor Odessa turns six, her mom dies like she's foreseen, and she realizes she's been cursed with the second sight. And cursed she was because her alcoholic dad is like, hey, we can definitely make money off this. So everyone in the Tsar's empire, from common people all the way on up to the nobles, came from miles around to take little Odessa's hand and learn their horrible futures.
Huh. I'm thinking this sounds like quite a good story. I have no memory of writing it, but I think it sounds like a pretty good opening.
Yeah, it is actually a good story. A sad one, but good. I mean, it's the Tsar's empire. Just imagine the worst possible outcome of a situation, make it sadder and bloodier, and then boom, you've told your own future. You don't need Odessa. So of course, Vladimir has to get in on this action. And in a flashback, we can move forward, we see the Tsar shows up for his own session with little Odie, and look, Pyre's with him.
Yay!
Pyre's back, hey!
My favorite. favorite guy to draw.
He's not dead.
I do actually like drawing Pyre.
Yeah.
He's a lot of fun.
You said he was your favorite to draw.
That's because he's never the same. You can draw him as anything. Yeah. You just basically invent a monster and Pyre is it.
Yes.
And he's got a big kind of...
Basically a Centauran with tusks.
Hair, yeah. Head with a shark's mouth and a tail.
He's many things.
And Dante killed his goat.
So Pyre's looking resentful as ever. And so then we see that Odie sees the awful death of her father a year from now with a pimp's knife in his heart covered in his own urine. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Wait, this is a Dante story. It must be about Dante, no?
We haven't gotten to him yet. He will show up, spoiler alert. So anyway, Odie's session with the Tsar goes well. The Tsar wisely asks only about the fates of others, never his own fate. So I think a shrewd decision by the Tsar to not...
I think the Tsar is shrewdly aware of the perils of power,
He
said alliteratively.
Yes. So then Odie becomes personal oracle to the Tsar. And he keeps her in sort of a gilded cage of luxury and consults her to further his domination of the world. So what does Odie do in isolation? She reads those Nicolai Dante romance magazines that everyone seems to be so excited about.
Yeah, I wrote them as well. You know, any chance to make an extra buck or two, I'll do that.
Yeah. No, I kind of want to read them, actually. I would love to read the actual magazines and sort of have a split, like, this is what the magazine said and then what really happened after it.
You should
I'm
do
sure.
like Watchmen, like end pieces, like fake media about the central performance.
That's right.
Yeah,
we could be like Watchmen. So Odie gets older and she starts to figure out that she's assisting a merciless dictator and feels like not so great about that. And she also, if we'll go to the next page, she doesn't feel so great about getting nearly murdered when she's finally let out of her cage a few times a year under armed guards by dudes dressed as Santa Claus. So this is a group called the Devil's Martyrs, who we've met before, and she's got kidnapped by them.
They're famous for their beards.
Yes, and she gets taken to a cabin in the woods.
Their first appearance is famously drawn by Chris Weston.
Yes, Space Boy.
Space Boy, as he was written at the time.
Yeah, I was... chatting about that earlier on.
What did you say about it?
Oh, no, Chris on the writer earlier. Yeah, it was an example of an artist doing something with a script that you weren't quite expecting when it arrived and didn't know quite what to do with it after that. So the 2000 AD put it in a plastic bag that time and put it out.
Because there was too much sex in it?
I suspect that was the reason, yeah.
Probably.
It was the sex special.
It was the sex special.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's the only time somebody's actually corrected art on a Dante story, because somebody drew with a biro pen on the Chris Weston artwork a G-string. I'm not joking. It's there. You can see it's even like biro. It's like, it's what? Who did that? Was it Andy Diggle? Who was
editor? I have no idea. I was quite annoyed because...
you were looking forward to it.
Dante doesn't wear G-strings.
Go ahead. No, talk.
This is a Christmas story. I've just remembered that we published a Christmas issue. So the fact that the bad guys are dressed as Santa was obviously my concession to
Christmas.
To
Christmas time.
Your Christmas stories are always so uplifting and lovely.
It is, I have to say, beautifully Christmassy painted. I mean, John is really knocking it out of the park with the painting.
Yeah.
It's so charming and Dickensian.
So these guys are apparently leftovers from the cult of Rasputin, who have apparently fallen from grace since we last saw them, from fun sex cults to child nappers. It's quite a fall. And apparently they've done a lot for the Tsar and are mad that he's now freezing them out. So one of these jerks then is monologuing to Odie and asks when he's going to die. This little hardcore preteen is like, sooner than you think. We see that in the next bit, I think. So we can go to the next page. Yep. And then just who comes through the window to kill the asshat with a Romanov looks like branded grenade comes Nicolai Dante crashing through a window. So everybody drink. That's the drinking game.
Yeah.
There we go. We actually have people here drinking. It's wonderful. So Dante makes short work of these fools. And that's on the next page after this brilliant splash here.
Great slicing action. Yeah. In that. I mean, really, I can't think of anyone who does that better.
Yeah, he just slashes him right across the gut. So I don't know, does that count as disemboweling?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that is the definition of disemboweling.
Is it?
Yes.
Just across.
Yeah.
Do the guts have to spill out for it to be disembowel, or is it just enough to cut it?
I mean, that adds to the theater, certainly.
Okay. I don't know these things, so. So Odie is so excited that she introduces Dante to himself, saying, "You're Dante, Nikolai Dante." And so Dante basically adopts her immediately. And there's an opening, because we left Carl and Mina, the ragamuffin pirate orphans, with Mama Dante and Lauren back at the start of Sword of the Tsar. And I realized when I saw this young child he bonds with, whatever happened to them? I don't know if we ever find out,
but we haven't
seen anything since then.
Any plans?
You don't remember, do you, Robbie?
You'd think the writer would know the answer to that, but I can't remember what happened to them either. I think they went off and lived happily ever after.
And just
unlike most of the people in that
Mama thing. Dante and Lauren started a little family with them.
And that's no canon, people.
So anyway, Dante got the drop on this rebel faction of the Rasputin cults. Because he's still buddies with Lady Eudocia. Is it Eudocia with the X-I-A? I don't know how to pronounce it. Do you know how to pronounce it?
I pronounce it? No, I just type the letters in.
All right. So Dante drives our little oracle to safety through the snow while she wears a fetching little white hooded fur coat.
I do like this sled thing. It looks actually brilliant.
It really looks like a fairy tale, this whole bit. If you want a page down
I
and look
one.
At more of this page.
Can I have one?
Look at how pretty it is.
To be honest, it's quite Dr. Zhivago, which I was watching again recently. I don't know if I gave any John any reference to what make it look like that, or whether John's obviously a master in his own right. He just did it on that, which is probably more than likely.
It could be either or both.
Yeah.
So Odie has a little monologue here where she tells Dante what it's like being the Tsar's fortune teller and how her abusive dad used to sell her services. And that this whole second sight thing makes her realize that people really should be just living instead of worrying over how they die.
Seems fair.
Wisdom.
Wow.
Wisdom.
I'm impressed. This guy's good.
And Odie's so pitiful that Dante decides to take her on a fun trip to Rudenstein. Hey kid, you think you're depressed now? Let's take a Christmas trip to Rudenstein. Things went so well the last time we were there.
Next day is the Tunguska Alienation Zone.
Exactly. So you think he's going to leave Odie in the woods and fuck off back to St. Petersburg while she almost gets eaten by a werewolf?
Don't look at me.
That's what happened
to
Elena. If you don't remember, you left Elena in the woods once.
Yeah?
Yeah. A werewolf almost ate her.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
It's all right. Elena's super competent.
She is. She made it through.
Oh, that was the Beast of Rudenstein.
There you go.
Hey.
Yeah.
See? It's all coming back. So Dante walks Odie up to the governor's mansion in the snow. Just fairy tale panels all over the place. They have a cute snowball fight. And Odie tells Dante that she lied for him to the Tsar. So the Tsar had asked if Dante would be loyal to him, and she says, "I lied." So that's the next part of that. So
crucially vague on that, what the actual lie was.
Well, presumably, I'm thinking it must be when Vlad took on Dante as sort of the Tsar.
She told him he would be loyal.
Oh,
yes, exactly.
But we walk that. Sort of the Tsar is like, we look at him, he's not going to be loyal to anybody.
Yes. Well,
yeah, we know that because we know Dante, but they don't know it.
That's what I was saying. Perhaps that's why the Tsar has been trusting Dante with all these missions. He figures my magic child says it's chill.
It does explain a little bit of like the Tsar's incredible confidence.
Well, also, we know that Dante wants to protect his daughter at all costs.
Okay.
Her fate is linked with the Tsar a lot.
Fair point.
He's got two things. It still stretches me a little bit just because
yes.
You cannot rely on this man. So the Tsar's maybe a little short-sighted here, but anyway, Odie asks if Dante wants to know about him and Jenna's future or his own death, and he wisely says no. He doesn't want to spoil the ending. So Dante also has a no-spoiler policy, like me. And they walk up to the governor's mansion in the snow, which is admittedly looking better than it did back in Beast of Rudenstein. And Dante cuddles the poor child and then gives in. This is the next and I think final page, yes. C- cuddles her a little bit, then gives in and asks, okay, tell me what my own death is. And Odie tells him that he dies spectacularly. And Dante says he can live with that. And that's the end.
Good ending.
That's the end.
Also great. Also great, great character pose on the end there. Great line, great
yes.
The whole thing. Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. It's this, like you know what you're doing. It's like crazy.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I can live with it having reread it. I'm quite happy with that story.
Yeah, it's good.
Doesn't always.
How much of it do you remember? I mean, it's like we're talking last night. It's like I said, I have never read all of Dante all the way through, and neither have you.
No.
You guys have read it more than we have.
I've read it three times.
Bingo.
Three times.
I mean, there's people who have read it a lot more than that, and I'm like, wow, okay. Because it just occurred to me, it's like, you just don't read it back. You never do. It's like, you've got too many things to worry about. It's like, I'll read back the old stuff. I don't do that.
To be honest, I haven't picked up any of the books for, I don't know, a few years probably. They're on a bookshelf, but I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to, okay, when I was still working, I would pick it up to refer back to things just to remind myself. But yeah, I never really sat and read the whole thing.
Yeah.
You just kind of, I mean, yeah, I had a loose plan as to where things were going, but you kind of write it and hope it all hangs together. But, you know, after...
But you say loose plan.
15 years worth of...
Right, because it was a five-year plan originally. That's a pretty loose plan.
Well, it wasn't really a five-year plan. It was that all came about from when we did the first... after the first series of Dante, Fleetway at the time set up Fleetway Film and Television, which was going to turn all the Fleetway properties such as Dread and Strontium Dog and Dante into films and television series. And partly what they did was they commissioned a few people to write Bibles for potential television series, one of which was Dante. And that forced me to sit down, because one of the things they wanted was you do five seasons worth for a television series just to prove that it had legs. So quite early on in the process, of just after having the first series commissioned, I was then putting that permission, also the good thing, they were paying you for the Bible, which was so it put you in the position of sitting down and, okay, I've got time and space and I'm being paid to work in advance and see where this can go. So I planned it out. It was never really a five-year plan. It was a five-season plan.
Do you ever were you ever paid to write a script for that?
Not a full script. I think you did a sort of the first 25 pages or something, the first quarter of it. But I mean, they are lost to...
It's such a long time ago. I remember you talking about it at the time, but I mean, I don't think I ever saw it.
Yeah, but I don't think anybody really saw it, apart from a couple of people, because the Fleetway Film and Television then sort of...
evaporated.
Yeah, so I don't know how many people would have seen
it. How did you get
the
rights
Bible
back to it, to be able to bring it to 2000 AD?
Well, you never, I mean, it was,
well,
this is post, this
Fleetway
is afterwards.
Oh, this is after.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Fleetway owned 2000 AD, so they were setting up their own company. So
technically, Fleetway owned the rights, but according to Rebellion, the contracting was so bad, they really didn't. So then we had to go and sign new contracts with Rebellion, which is basically everything I've ever done. Every time you sign a contract with Rebellion, at the end of it is, everything you've ever done for Rebellion belongs to Rebellion. I'm like, all right.
That was just a few years ago, I think you had to re-sign that, wasn't it?
No, it was
oh,
way,
it was
it was way back. Yeah, I remember, because it was like, it was a little bit contentious at the time.
Mm.
Just like, because the contracting at Fleetway Egmont was so lousy that Rebellion bought this company, which was supposedly full of IP and wonderful, amazing things, and they looked at the legal stuff and went, oh, balls. so they had to retroactively fix it, and which they had to do, and we all kind of like, sure.
Mm.
Then would have been the time to stage a palace revolution and
yes,
like, we'll take our babies back, please, but
yeah,
nobody did it.
Strike.
I know. <Didn't>
Who would have led the strike?
That would have had to have been John and Alan, probably.
Yeah.
It would have been, or Pat.
Yeah.
Yeah, Pat would have been the one to do it. Anyway, didn't happen.
So, yeah, but I mean, yeah, the Bible, and I mean, it's getting back almost, I don't know,
1998 or something, so all that stuff, if I have no copies of anything left, if they're probably on a floppy disk somewhere in a box in the loft, but you know, that's probably doesn't, but nobody can access any of the stuff. And apart from that, it was years ago, you probably quite ropey look back on it.
I mean, it counts. I mean, spoilers, I have actually read ahead, because the thing is, I know the facts of the plot, but I don't remember the emotion of the plot. So I went, oh, okay, so I'll read ahead a bit of what we're doing right now and just like try and refresh my memory. And I'm like, damn, this is actually pretty good. I'm actually enjoying this. Like, damn, there's some real big, there's some big stuff happening here. I was like, it really pays off well.
Yeah.
I was kind of like, wow. Because it's fine for people to tell you your works, they enjoy your work and you're enjoying whatever, it's good stuff, whatever. And you go, yeah, sure, thanks. But you're going back and I'm like, it's so far away in my head now. I'm reading it going, damn. This is talented work by aspiring young artists. And like, and I look at some of the later artwork and I'm like, I don't even know if I could draw that now. I'm like, that's depressing.
Yeah,
it's one of these things. I mean, I always tend to find when I've finished the script, you think you're professional and you hope you've done a good job. But once you've finished something, I'm never that keen on it when I've finished it. And usually when the comic first came in, when each episode came out, you look at that and sort of think, you just tend to see the flaws and you tend to be things where I could have done that better, I could have did this better, I could have done that better. But if you look at something a couple of years later, then when you've got a bit of distance, sometimes it's nice to look at something and think, look, as I've just did with that, and thought, actually it's not bad, it's pretty well done, it's all.
It's funny how once you remove the emotion and come back to it, you can read it fresh, and it's a new thing that isn't you anymore. It's kind of something you left behind, and it's like your kid came back from college and it's like actually much nicer than you remember them.
Have you had that experience, Simon?
Nothing. I couldn't possibly comment.
Oh my goodness.
It is a thing. I've talked to a bunch of people about this. Like, your kid goes away for a year and they come back and they're like nice and charming and polite, and they're like, who are you?
Well, we're at a real pivot point here in the story.
Yes.
I was talking with you last night, Robbie, and mentioning the big reveal was that Arkady has a crest now. And unfortunately he killed that lovely lady with it.
Mm-hmm.
But now we found this Oracle girl, so she's obviously got to fit in somehow with the Tsar's plans. And I'm actually concerned now, because if he can ask about people's futures, then whatever clearly Dante is plotting, I don't know.
I mean, saying that Dante is plotting anything is probably stretching it at this point.
He does have a loose plan. It's a five season plan. He's gone on. If we keep going this day, then
I mean, it's one of the nice things about this, the whole thing is, like, yes, Dante's set up as the hero of this story, but it takes him a long time to get his act together. He really isn't the hero in the kind of like, I've got a plan and I want to fix things in any sense until the latter two thirds of the way through. It's Army of Thieves and Whores, where he suddenly like picks it up and is like, oh, sorry. But yeah, he doesn't really have a plan. He's just winging it.
He just muddles through. Some ways,
it's fair.
He doesn't have all the answers. He's a flawed man. He's tries his best, but his best is often not good enough. And his best is obviously he's trying hard in the wrong direction. But eventually he gets to the.
And it's kind of more about other people's sort of intentions for him a lot of the time as well.
Well, initially when the series starts, he's just a young guy who wants to have a. Survive and have a good time, but
it's rare in 2000 AD you get a chance to like develop a character that much, because he changes a lot through the story, and almost no other 2000 AD character except maybe Halo Jones gives that much space.
Well, that was one of the things we wanted to do when we started it I think I initially looked at all the others when I think it was Steve McManus initially asked me first if you want to do something for 2000 AD, and I just looked at all the other strips that were running, and they were all Judge Dredd, grim, gritty veteran lawman, rogue trooper, grim, gritty veteran soldier, Johnny Alpha, who, probably my favourite character in 2000 AD, but he was a fairly grim, gritty veteran bounty hunter. And yeah, they never really changed. They never really changed as characters and developed. And they were all, to me at the time, they were all guys probably in their 40s. So I'd think, well, let's just do the opposite of it. Let's make it to somebody who's young, and he'll age and change as the series goes along. Potentially, if you get a second series.
Not uncoincidentally, he aged and changed in time with us. Because we were about the same age as him when we started it, more or less.
I suppose so, yeah. See, I wouldn't have considered that. I wouldn't have looked at it as an...
They're in their 30s now, because Jenna talks about it in one of the recent stories, and I actually did the math, and I was like, oh, they're in their 30s.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, not spoiling anything, but at the end, I'm drawing Dante as like a 40-ish-year-old man.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, wow, yeah, we've been some way here.
Yeah.
And there's the thing, that there's an opening page in America where he's looking at a pin-up picture of himself,
mm-hmm.
as sort of young floppy-haired
yes.
Dante, and it's like middle-aged, kind of like seen some shit Dante looking at a portrait of himself, going, whoa. And I'm like, yeah, and it was like,
isn't getting old crap, let alone when people are trying to kill you all the time, and they're
yeah.
dying, it's just bad enough to sort of look at yourself in the mirror and go, there's a bit of grey in my hair there.
Or listen, the people's idea of you is someone that was like 10 years ago, like, right, okay, yes. People have expectations of Dante, which aren't really, there's a sort of fantasy Dante out there. And I don't know, I love drawing that page because it was the idea that there's a kind of popular image of Dante who's this kind of heroic sort of cad. And there's Dante there who's actually trying to be a real person in real space and trying to be good sort of in context,
well,
morally relative.
Yeah, it's probably more lighthearted. The series is more lighthearted to begin with and it gets darker as it goes along. But again, that was probably always my thought for it, you know.
The war was pretty intense though.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But even that's still, you've been through a few series before that happens.
Yeah.
That's
things
have got.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you've established that you can send the character to war and change him radically and, you know, kill off quite a lot of the supporting cast.
Mm. And crucially bring him back from war as well.
Yeah, you bring him back and you try and rebuild him.
Yep.
But he's not going to be the same, you know, happy-go-lucky swashbuckling type that he was. And yeah, as a writer, you actually probably miss that old younger happy-go-lucky character.
We did get to go back with the 40th anniversary one, because that's, I think, is that a pre-war one? The 40th anniversary occasion?
You need to get somebody else to talk about continuity, probably. Did he have long hair on it?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, yes. It was
he did grow the hair back, but yeah.
He did grow.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's interesting because he actually does have tragedy quite young, because when we meet him, Ellie's already died. That whole thing already happened, which was awful.
Yep.
Who's Ellie?
His first wife.
Good Lord.
Oh,
he's
first wife.
Oh, good Lord. The great game, Robbie. Only one of my favorite characters in the entire series.
Well,
killed brutally.
Yeah, I think if I was doing it again, I would have probably kept her.
Yes.
Kept her.
It's good to hear that. Because she was wonderful.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't have killed her off and kept her as a sort of recurring character.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have ended up even more of a sort of
I would have
conflicted
loved,
love interest.
Yeah, I was going to say, her and Jenna kind of facing off. We got a little bit of it, but not much.
But it was still quite early on. You know, you don't know.
Yeah.
I now look back in hindsight and think, yeah, I would have kept her along.
Yeah.
She would have probably been killed off at some point during the series, but
sure.
I would have kept her on. As
we could have got to know her maybe better, yeah.
Yeah, but it's that you have, when I think back, I mean, they were 5-page episodes for whatever reason, I can't remember.
We were doing a big splash thing and then there was
five-page episodes, you've only got, you know, there's the practicalities of writing a story of, like, yeah, you want to flesh. I always had problems with Dante and that you had such a big supporting cast and you wanted to flesh out the supporting cast, but you've got 6 pages,
mm-hmm.
6 pages a week with, you know, 6-7 panels a page, and there's only so much you can do. So a lot of it's shorthand, and you try, you know, it's quite broad strokes character work.
I did a Doctor Who comic, and like, so the second season of it, we had like 5 companions in the TARDIS, and one of them was Absalom Dark, and it's like, this is stupid. Because everybody's like standing around while everybody, the other people are doing is like, an Absalom Dark just standing around doesn't work. That's not Absalom Dark. So I was like, this isn't working at all, guys. We can't do this. Yeah. And it's kind of in the show, too. If there's too many characters and if there's too many like companions on the screen at the same time, it's like, it's kind of distracting.
I like more companions, but we disagree on this one. But I do understand what you're saying. It was very weird seeing the Dalek killer just sort of leaning against the wall while people talk to each other.
Not killing Daleks. Like,
not
that's
killing
not
Daleks.
The story.
That's not how that works.
His only character description is kills Daleks and drags his dead
and
girlfriend
drags
around.
His dead wife around.
Yeah.
With a chainsaw.
He has a chainsaw for a reason, and it's not to
not to trim the lawn. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, it's wonderful to see this character go through, and I think someone asked me recently. I think we talked about this on the podcast. You know, how has reading Dante, close reading it all together like this, has it changed anything about how I read comics? And I said yes, because I feel like I've gotten much more accepting of characters who have a lot of flaws and maybe aren't nice people, and getting to follow their stories, that they don't have to be, you know, heroic or really even good people at all to still have an interesting story to tell. And I think Dante is very much that.
It's true. Protagonist rather than, like, you don't have to identify with a hero. Mm. It's a protagonist.
It's fun to watch him struggle, yeah. I guess, because we struggle. And
fail.
Yeah. We fail. Yeah. So it feels more real.
Yep.
For sure. But
or as real as somebody whose swords growing out can be. But yeah. But yeah, no. Cheers. No.
Yeah.
What's our timing like?
Yeah, well, we've got about 10 minutes, so I thought maybe we could take some questions. Yes, Content Colin. Here live.
Yeah, so Robbie, we see Simon's art and John's art change over the course of such a long story. But I'm not as consciously aware of how your writing changes. Are you aware of your writing changing the way that we would see Simon's and John's art
changing?
Yeah,
I just started off brilliant and I just kept cruising along. I don't know, hopefully it gets better. I mean, there's certainly the first couple of series are there's things I look back and I think, oh, it's all over the place. Some of the plotting's poor, the pacing's poor. I think it gets better as it goes along. I think the one thing that did work, we did get right with Dante, was that he arrived as a fully formed character. I think from page one, Dante as a character, obviously he changes as a character as the series goes along. But he arrived as, this is him. It wasn't, you know, I knew the character and we knew the character. He was just there. Whereas a lot of stuff, you know, you see in series and you see the characters being developed, you realise they haven't quite got this together yet. So whereas I think a lot of the storylines and a lot of the world building at the start is a bit, you know, I can look back and see it's a bit ropey at points, but the character always worked. I think from day one, and then, you know, as it carries on, hopefully the storylines and hopefully the scripting gets better as you get, you know, the writing gets better as you get older and more practiced, and you know the character and.
Do you find you've got more confidence in doing that, and so you're able to take more risks with it because you are getting those skills and stuff?
I suppose so with Dante, yeah. But I mean, every series is different. You know, if I was starting a new series and writing something else, I wouldn't have that same confidence that I would have had with Dante. You try to have confidence in yourself as a writer or any sort of creator. And I say that because I've been doing it for a long time, so I know that, yeah, I must be doing something right. So, yeah, I guess it's you do have sort of confidence, yeah.
Well, it works. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, who else do we got? Saw some hands up. Okay.
Yeah. When it came to, so Simon, you worked on pretty much nearly everything before you stepped back a little bit for, and then John came in. There were a few early episodes where there was a lot of artists as well.
Yeah.
But was there an intimidation factor with John coming on board?
Oh, hell yes. Are you kidding? Because we made a list, we had like a dream list at the beginning. It was like Dante was supposed to be like a continuation of like Don Lawrence, Dragon Empire, like even to a certain extent Dan Dare. It's like, who are these great adventure comics? Like, you know, the British comics that came before 2000 AD. And, you know, who are the list of artists who are like that? And like Burns was on that list, of course. And then we didn't even ask him because we didn't think he'd be interested. But he asked Dave Bishop and was like, he's like, what? Okay, I mean, what are you going to say? No. The thing about it is like you got to ask yourself as you're doing something like this, you're bringing another artist in to take over on something you're working on. You've got to ask yourself, do you want somebody to come in who's not very good or not as good as you are, which is a very kind of egotistical point to take, but it's like, do you don't want to be overshadowed, which is, you know, my vanity, I would say, you know, I don't want to be overshadowed. However, or do you bring someone on who's just fucking amazing? And will blow the whole thing up. And I've talked to artists who I respect, Walt Simonson, for example. I had a long conversation about Walt Simonson, who's a huge John M. Burns fan. He doesn't know a damn thing about me. And he hasn't really read Dante, but he read the John M. Burns bit. So I'm like, sure, as long as you're reading it, that's fine.
And Robbie, when you realized that John was hopping on board, and you were writing for him, was there an intimidation factor, do you recall?
I was just delighted, no. But I think by the time John came on, I knew I was doing... I was comfortable with the character and the storyline. No offence, Simon, but it's just... obviously, 2000 wanted to keep it going and keep more, you know, and one artist can only do so much material.
I mean, we're a victim of our own success here.
Being selfish, I was quite happy to write as many scripts as possible. And if I'm, I don't know if I've ever told you this, confession time. When it first came, when I first put an outline together for Dante and put it in, I didn't really have Simon in mind for it at all. In fact, John was one of the first artists I actually suggested.
Yeah.
And at the time, I don't know, David Bishop was saying, "Oh, he's not." I think they wanted to keep him on Judge Dredd at the time. Now, I don't mean that as anything, because at that point, Simon was drawing Shimura. And me, with the typical writer's or freelancer's mentality, would have thought, well, you know, like I've got Simon and Shimura, and that's going well. That's great. I'm really liking that. So if I get somebody else on Dan, I have two series that I'm writing. But I know I've got a great artist on Shimura, and then hopefully I'll get a great artist on this. But then, I think it was John Tomlinson, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think this was before David Bishop came on board. Yep. I think
John
Tomlinson said to me, "Oh, I was thinking of asking Simon Fraser to do it." And I sort of went, "Oh, she's doing Shimura, blah, 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 blah." And, you know, this is where you can't stand if you know, I wasn't going to then try and put the kibosh on any of that, because it's a... opportunity for you, you know, that should be that's sort of your decision. So he asked, I think John had mentioned you, so I went, "Oh, okay."
There aren't any like character sketches by other artists lying around I should know about.
No, I never got that far.
Like
I never got that far.
Dante Starkiller or something, like what?
No, it never got that far, but I was just looking at it as a freelancer. I would have happily been writing Shimura with you on Shimura and Dante with somebody else. But
it's hard to see where Shimura could have gone after.
At that point, I hadn't sat down and did my 5-season plan for Shimura at that point yet. So, and as it worked out perfectly, partly because I love Dante and I love Simon's art work on Dante, and I love the way the whole thing came together. And also, not long after, I think we started doing Dante, the magazine cut its page count and stuff like this, so they weren't really commissioning much anymore. So I could have lost Simon entirely as an artist if it hadn't gone that way.
Could have gone to America.
Yeah. So it's.
Did you radically change your writing approach such that it's like, this is definitely a Simon story and this is definitely a John story?
Not to begin with, because probably some of the scripts were already written. But later on, you start to tailor different story. John's, I probably would enhance more of the historical side of it, because John wasn't a massive fan of you know, high tech science fiction stuff. So, and then if I was writing something for Simon, I would try and.
Well, there was the beginning of part of the war stuff, sort of stuff. We started out with the war, and I was having trouble with it. I wasn't a big fan of the war. I mean, drawing, I wasn't a very big fan of war comics, and it was hard to do. And then we swapped over, John and I, because John was doing Battleship Potemkin, supposed to be. And
oh,
I was,
yeah,
that worked out better because I had to do like sort of ship battles and stuff like
that's
that.
That's quite high tech.
It was fun, and John didn't like doing that at all, so he ended up doing like the gloomy, gloomy, moody war stuff, which like was much more his thing than mine.
Yeah, but I did, I would have tailored it into some degree. No, not in terms of the broad storyline, but just in terms more of the sort of, you know, or in choosing locations or choosing what kind of action sequences you would write or that, I would do it there. And there are some characters I sometimes think of as more Jones than yours, like Elena Kurakin and all the Rudenstein irregulars, who all, they all appear the Jones thing, and I always, you know, in my head, I always see Elena as John's character,
mm-hmm.
and the way he developed her, and I love the way he drew her as well, you know.
Made her very cute.
Yeah.
Very kind of cutesy.
Yeah.
Like some of the close-ups are like,
yeah,
it's a bit chocolate.
Yeah, but you made her not cutesy, and it's like she's not.
She's a Mongolian swordswoman.
Yeah.
From
she's
the
a
steps.
Mongolian swordswoman. In 2000 AD,
yeah,
that means she has to be
Listen,
a sexy Mongolian.
Don't box her in. She can have lip gloss and still be a swordsman.
It's
sword
not like there aren't enough sexy characters in Dante.
Yeah.
I think we have time for one more question.
It's a tough question. So if Odessa's right and Nicolai Dante's death is spectacular, what makes that story not worth telling?
Because you told
spoilers
it yourself.
Yeah,
closure.
Yeah,
you did it yourself. You kind of, you can now take that story yourself.
I think you're right. It's interesting you say.
And
it.
To throw a spanner in the works, can people change their destinies and people change their futures? Can so you might, you know, that might have been what she foresaw for him then, but his path may have changed and things. You know, it's not. I probably always imagine the foretelling the future thing. It's not an exact process. It's a thingy. You know, I mean, spectacularly could mean he slipped in the bathroom while he was drinking a bottle of champagne and then still, he still went out in style, you know. But yeah, I mean, in some ways I quite like it. It's, are there more stories to tell? How did it end? Did he go back to Jena, or did he go off and be a sad old man trying to live like a hellraiser and chasing women and drinking and go back to the...
We did discuss this. Yeah.
Did he go back to that old lifestyle of what he has at the start? But then, you know, you can't. Can you do that? Can you go back and retrieve your youth in that respect? It's, I like the fact that it's kind of. Well, it's up to the, you know, the readers can make their own imagination, because you've worked on something for it. And the nice thing with doing Dante is that people liked it and people cared about it as much, you know, in the same way we did. So in some ways, I think once it's done and it's out there, it's still yours, but it's also the readers who have invested time and, you know, their own imaginations in it, and if they cared about the character, then it's, you know. And I swither, I swither with the ending. If I'm in a bad mood, then he had a really rotten old time. And another, sometimes I think, no, did he go back? No, maybe he went back and he lived happily ever after. Maybe it's so. I swither quite a lot in my own head as to, you know, where, what ultimately happened after that.
Because I've said it a lot of times. I've said it here to a few people. Is like Dante. If I draw Dante, it reflects my state of mind. Like it's like therapy. It's like I draw Dante and look at him and go, oh, that's where I am. And if he's in a cheerful mood, which he was this morning, I'm like, oh, I'm in a good place. That's nice, even though I got 2.5 hours sleep. It's like, that's great. And periodically I draw him and he's looking old and a bit beat up. And it's like, oh, shit. Because Dante exists as a real thing. It's like he came fully formed and he still exists in my head. So it's like, yeah, he's alive. He's out there somewhere. And his destiny changes according to my mood.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what it looks like, so enough said. But we are closing. So we're closing the book on Dante for today, but we'll be back next time with The Tsar's Daughter We hope you enjoyed our podcast. If so, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, leave us ratings and reviews, tell your friends, follow us on Instagram at PodTGDR. Let us know what you think of the podcast, Dante, comics, whatever is on your mind. I'm Edie.
I'm Simon.
And that's Robbie.
Robbie, yeah.
And we will catch you next time.
Well, bye.